Welcome to episode 37 of Gallifrey Public Radio. We've got the golden ticket, and we plan on using it to hold off the invading hordes. It's time to talk about Nightmare in Silver. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Witten.
We need somebody who is more intense.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect Whovian name.
And Keir Hansen.
The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 37 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we plan out our Whovian discussions three moves ahead of time. Checkmate! I am Keir, joining in the GPR studios here, along with Melissa. Good evening, Melissa.
Good evening, Keir. How are you?
Excellent indeed. And the lovely and talented Jay is also with us. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic.
All right. We have to take a quick moment right off the top here to fall on our swords for what feels to us like deja vu. I felt like we just did episode 37, strangely enough, but
yeah,
we kind of did. What happened?
Well, it was a perfect storm of problems. First we had to reschedule our night because of traveling, and then luggage got lost, and things got pushed back further, and then computers crashed before we started recording, and then, all said and done at the end, trying to transfer over the file, and power goes out and it gets corrupted and is not, possibly salvageable. And it's just clearly some greater power did not want this coming out.
and our overwhelming professionalism was unable to combat this mighty foe.
Yes.
Try though we did, because it got corrupted at the very end. We went through these things to finally try to podcast, and we recorded. For those who don't know, we did record something, but
we pushed through. We soldiered on, and when all things were considered, it wasn't meant to be. So
in summary, here's basically what you missed. Last week's ineptly named episode 37, which was our discussion of the Crimson Horror, was basically our opportunity to look back on the episode and say, you know what? No, not so much. I think we were all pretty much in agreement that it was one of the low points of Series 7. Melissa
I really liked it, and I want that out there, that I really liked the Crimson Horror, but we were in agreement about most points. The things that I liked about it were the things that you and most other people didn't like, right?
Yeah. So we were just blindly following public opinion on it.
Yeah, clearly.
Public opinion was following us.
There it goes, yeah.
Right. And then there was Melissa alone on the hill.
Yeah. No, I mean, ultimately it came down to, at least my take on it was that it had a lot of great moments, but ultimately they added up to a really bad episode.
And my general feel was that it was two episodes sort of worked together, two iterations of a script that neither of which was really ready for full production. The first half being one that really focused on Vostra and Jenny and Strax. And the other half, where the entire story was really being told as we normally see things from the, doctor and companion's perspective. And it somewhere halfway through the episode did a flip, and it didn't seem very, very well stitched. So.
Yeah. And what I liked about it was the Vostra, Jenny, Strax stuff and not the doctor stuff. So I really agreed with you there that it felt like two scripts merged together. So that was basically our opinion on that. Right.
But one of the things we were all very, very much in agreement on was the fact that the slight involvement or the slight references to the fact that we had three characters who knew the oddity of the fact that Clara was standing there in front of them and kept trying to address it with the doctor.
Yeah, and nothing came of it.
Right. So, and that got us into a really good discussion towards the end of this episode. It was probably the best part of the whole recording we had going on last week, was our talking about the fact that knowing what we're supposed to be led into in the finale next week, by the way, finale next week, is really missing something. It's like, you know, there's like an engine misfire in there because we don't have the big, compelling, you know, lead us all up into this finale with huge questions on our mind and things that need to be addressed and adventures and peril and worry and concern. And it didn't feel like we had that, really. Yeah.
No,
I mean, if you felt that about last week's episode, I'm really curious to hear about this week's.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I definitely want to put on the table because I think we're getting more of the same. But we'll get to this. You know, you look at the first half of Series 7, and you look at the fact that as sad as it was, you know, knowing what we were going to be getting to by the time we get to the Angels Take Manhattan, we knew. We even knew the nature of what the conclusion was going to be, not necessarily how it was going to get executed, but you know the fact that we were going to lose two of our companions. And this had been something that gave us this thread that we were able to – it made us really appreciate every episode leading up to it because every interaction between them, every line, every gesture, every facial, you know, little moment that they shared meant something to us. And this latter half of the series – I haven't got that. I almost don't care. But, I'm not going to say I don't care, but I'm not compelled, you know?
Yeah.
The mystery's gone.
Yeah, that was something that I mentioned last week, that, like, I remember saying that the Clara mystery was, like, the big thing for me, and I really couldn't wait till it was resolved, and, you know, what cool thing are they going to do with this? And then the fact that they've been just putting it off or whatever they're doing, it by this point, I don't care anymore.
Yeah, it should have been getting a much bigger build up, and it's just kind of, well, you know, we've gotten more reminders of, oh yeah, there's a mystery going on that we've forgotten about until they just brought it up now. And that's all we've been getting. We haven't gotten any information. It's just kind of, hey, remember this because it's going to come into play later. There's going to be a quiz on this at the end of class, you know.
Well, all right. Well, let's. We mentioned the fact that we're getting kind of more of the same with it this week. And again, this past week with knowing who was at the, you know, whose hand was on the pen and our expectation levels, as much as we did not want to put expectations into this, we just wanted to appreciate it. Okay. You know, and I know, and you know that I know, and I know that you know that I know that we were putting big expectations on this.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't get away from it. I mean, it's a Neil Gaiman penned episode. There's a certain level of clout there that you just can't get away from. And yeah, you know, ultimately he said that he did not want to write another Doctor Who episode unless he was able to top the Doctor's wife. I personally feel like he didn't reach that goal. That's not to say I think it's a bad episode, but it definitely wasn't as good as his first outing.
Agreed.
Well, I think one of the only ways that I can kind of rectify it to myself, because I completely agree on both sides of that point, the fact that it is an enjoyable episode, but it is definitely not – it does not reach that bar.
Yeah.
But I guess maybe that's because I'm looking at Doctor's Wife as being a brilliantly written piece because of the dialogue, because of the character interaction, because of the way that he, as the writer that he is – plays with the English language. Whereas this was a good adventure story.
Yeah.
Probably one of the best we've had since Clara arrived.
Yeah. I don't know, it's with Neil Gaiman, I mean he has a definite style of writing that if you know Gaiman, you understand. Like you can hear him in the language of his writing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times what he does is, you know, he will you know, create like a bubble universe. If he's writing in an established world, he'll create like a bubble universe, you know, kind of literally in The Doctor's Wife. And that way he can write what he wants and have it, you know, it's in this world, kinda. You know, in this one, he really didn't get that option. It was kind of, okay, here's the parameters. You have to fit in here. And he's never as strong when you put that kind of boundary on him.
Well, I think he thrives on his ability to take what we know and hand it back to us at a, you know, slightly askew.
Mm-hmm.
So that it forces us to kind of, you know, change a lot of our basic observations and preconditions about the characters that we know or the locations that we think we know and things of that sort. So he takes the classic, you know, abandoned amusement park premise of horror and mystery stories aplenty.
Yeah.
And decides to use it as the backdrop for the revival of what he considers to be, you know, one of the most terrifying Hooniverse villains we could possibly face. And I think sells that. This is not just the usual, oh, they're going to take your brain, you know, and use it. I mean, they're harvesting humans for their own, like a repair shop outpost, essentially.
Yeah. And I mean, it's done in such a way that it's really actually, you know, scary. Not really creepy, and I'm going to have nightmares about this, but, and you think about it, you go up against a robot who every time you do something to stop him, upgrades and keeps coming. I mean, that's scary. It gets to the point where, you know, eventually you're going to run out of ideas, and the only option you have left is to blow up the planet.
Right. Casualties be damned.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, there's no other way to stop this thing. We've tried this, we've tried that, we tried the other thing, and each one of them stopped a couple of them, but they just keep coming. There's nothing left to fall back on.
What did you guys think of the Cybermen just in general, like the way that they are in this episode?
Oh, the new look is fantastic.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that vacant look in the face. I mean, it's weird because, I mean, it's not horribly different than it was before. I mean, there's enough difference you can tell, but it's not drastically different, but there's just something about the empty look of the face that just makes it that much more, you know, horrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I read a review of the episode that talked about how Gaiman loves to play with Freud's idea of the uncanny. And before I had even read that article, that was kind of what I was thinking of. Like, these are like uncanny Cybermen. They're slightly human, so there's like a familiarity there, and we've seen them in so many episodes, so it's like they're like a classic villain, that there's that familiarity there. But that vacant look, man, you're like, you hit the nail on the head. Like, there's just something so eerie and creepy about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this take this time around on the Borg-like assimilation of humans, and in this case, Time Lords as well.
Yeah.
But just that ability to be able to quickly, the mites, being able to very quickly take over the physical form is a natural progression, or you know, dare I say, it's a natural upgrade to the way that they go about, you know, taking out their foes, that it ups the creepy factor infinitely.
And it's something that they can play with now in future episodes. You can always bring back the Cybermen and change them and tweak them, because now we know that they can evolve and all that.
Right, that being the last thing that we see floating through through space before the closing credits. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. When the Doctor first names these as the Cyber Mites, was he like coming up with that name off the cuff?
That's what it seemed like. He's like, yeah, a smaller version of the Cybermats, Cyber Mites. Yeah. So yeah, it seemed like he was just like, this is the most logical name.
They get referred to by Cyberwebley as the Cybermites like 15 minutes later.
Well, I mean, it really is the most logical name that you're going to get for him. So I don't know if it's so much that the Doctor was, you know, had a stroke of genius and said, this is what I'm going to name them. It's just like, you know, these were the Cybermats. Clearly the best name for this would be the Cybermites, and he just happened to get it right.
Okay. Fair enough. Definitely, they reminded me quite a bit of the probes from The Matrix.
Yeah. They really did. Yeah.
Just noticing.
The fact that they're like, you know, just little silverfish, and they're all over the place and nobody even notices them. I mean, they make so much more sense than the Cybermats. You know, it's like you've got this tiny little insect that you want to send in as a spy or whatever the case is. And, you know, that makes sense as opposed to a, you know, house slipper painted silver with a mustache. It's like, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm going to notice that.
Yeah. Well, you work with what you have in the prop closet.
Oh, I know. I'm just saying that it's like, given how long it's been and given what we've got now, it's like, if they hadn't gone this route, it would. I mean, when I saw the Cybermat in closing time, it was kind of like, yeah, that's kind of stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this just seems like the natural progression.
And they're a lot creepier. Like, a Cybermat was never really scary.
I don't know. The little teeth were kind of terrifying at times, but.
Yeah. Well. It was scary when it had our favorite characters, like, about to kill them or whatever. But I think if you saw it on the street, you wouldn't be scared. Whereas the Cybermites, which is, like, there's so many of them.
Yeah, it's on your shoulder and you don't even realize it.
Right. Well, that actually leads us nicely into our sort of questioning the Cybermites and things. That was one of the things that came along with some feedback that we got from one of our listeners. Shooter got in touch with us. As he often does with some very eloquent assessments of not only the episode, but just some concerns. He sort of seems to be in agreement with us that it was definitely an entertaining episode. But similarly to Melissa, I know you had a lot of issue with some gaps and inconsistencies in the way that the story played through.
Yeah, so I mean, let's talk about Shooter. Okay, so I think we all agree that we liked this episode. So, was just like, when I looked back at my notes, it was almost all just like plot hole, plot hole, plot hole. Like I listed them, and it got to be kind of distracting. So Shooter has a lot, and we're like, I want to talk about them, but I kind of want to add to his list too because there was more than that. So, you know, there were the plot holes, and that's okay in like a 44 minute show or whatever, but again, this was Gaiman, we had high expectations. Right. So let's talk about what Shooter said, if you guys want to.
Well, he was concerned about the fact that the Doctor had even made mention when they were coming off of this Spacey Zoomer or Space Zoomy Spacer Zoomer, the anti-grav ride.
Spacey Zoomer, because I thought that they were saying Zuma the whole time.
So they're gonna go do Zumba. And he said that he had to start to, he had to keep an eye out for insects. And Shooter felt that kind of came out of the blue. Correct me if I'm wrong, in a number of scenes previously, he had just been sort of doing some general sweeps with a screwdriver and may have noticed the fact that there were some, you know, small cybernetic forms, of small scale, you know, shifting about. So maybe that's what he was referring to.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I got out of it was that he was just talking about the Cybermites.
Yeah. Not having seen them yet, but knowing that there's something there.
Maybe seeing something and saying, that shouldn't be there, you know.
Because he was scanning the hell out of everything in the Wax Museum, which, by the way, I'm still going to have to go back and watch that a little more closely to see what some of the statues were in the background. Because I got a feeling we had some classic villains back there.
Yeah.
There was a gargoyle that I thought was a weeping angel for a minute.
For a second. That's all I noticed, yeah. Could have been a nice little Angels Take Manhattan reference there.
No, at that point, her brain just kind of shut down for a couple of minutes. She's like, oh, wait, show's still on. Okay.
The Shooter was also wondering why the Doctor referenced missing children at the park.
Yeah, I really think that was just, you know, a setup to, you know, when they stole the kids later. It was just kind of, okay, we made reference to the fact that they're stealing children, so the fact that we're coming in to steal the children makes sense.
Well, and it did make sense from, you know, the Cybermen point of view that the natural plasticity of a child's brain is amenable to their upgrades. So it did make sense. But I think his point was more of like, why would you bring them to a place where children are going missing, you know?
Yeah, that's a pretty valid point. I mean, I assumed initially that this choice of location was something where, you know, like the Doctor is wont to do. Gets a new companion in the TARDIS and wants to impress them by taking them someplace that's really going to wow them. You know, having the full breadth of time and space to experiment with, he's going to go to an amusement park for the kids. He just happened to choose a really bad one.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole idea of a planet that is a theme park and is abandoned, I mean, that's just, I've seen pictures of old abandoned theme parks, like around America. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, some of those pictures are downright terrifying. They're just like, I would not want to be caught there in broad daylight, you know.
Yeah.
There's just something creepy about it. So if you think, I mean, if you take that one roller coaster sitting out in the really tall grass and the mist and everything and blow that up planet scale, I mean, that's kind of scary right there.
I
The whole amusement park on a planet. Do you guys watch Futurama?
Yeah.
It reminded me of the moon theme park, the whalers on the moon.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that one. Okay.
Did anyone else catch the fact that where they landed at the very beginning of the episode when they said that it was something like a moon base? I was reading that that's actually a very faithful recreation of the moon base from the first or second Cyberman story with Patrick Troughton.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's...
What, the Tomb of the Cybermen?
I forget which one it was, but it's basically spot on for the moon base.
That's cool.
Nice. So, just so you could say, here's how we can make it look really bad, by doing what we used to do.
Yeah.
One of Shooter's questions, which I think can be pretty quickly dismissed, was what the captain had said to Angie when she said that we have to have a little chat and took her off camera. I'm pretty sure that's where we picked up the next time we see them, and their conversation gets interrupted.
Yeah, it definitely didn't feel like there was anything important if there was anything said. Maybe like who are you talking about? Who's these people that you're hanging out with? Are they this person here? And then, they get interrupted. So it's...
Right. Angie had just been making reference to the fact that there was the little guy.
Yeah.
I think the captain wanted to kind of question her on that. And that's the thread of conversation that gets interrupted when Clara comes running in to try and find out where she wandered off to.
Yeah. So. And that's also the point where I just wanted to slap Angie upside the head so bad and then continue throughout the rest of the freaking episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really obnoxious character work there. If that's actually how British preteens behave, I'm just going to stay here. Thanks.
It's so
really
one-dimensional. Great. What was the point of even having those kids there?
There wasn't a purpose. I mean,
Artie, I could stand Artie. Artie was inquisitive, but he was concerned enough to respect distance and didn't want to poke his nose into things. And
his only purpose was to act scared, though. I mean, that's the only thing you get out of him, is he gets freaked out. And I'm sorry, if you're, crawling around an abandoned amusement park planet, I'm not going to look at the kids and be like, you know what, you wait here and take a nap. It's just, no, bad parenting.
Mm. We have to address the fact that Clara seemed able to suddenly jump in and take command of this ragtag platoon, and yet she gets very, very quickly duped by the cyber planner to get the trigger away from her to the planet destruction bomb.
I mean, that was just, she had just smacked the doctor and he came back to his senses. It's like, okay, this is the doctor. She knows that for sure now. She wasn't aware of the fact that, he was literally split in half between the two of them to where, one of them had control of each arm.
Right.
So, she thought, okay, it's the doctor. The doctor's in control. I can get closer now and be safe. She didn't know that the cyber planner could control that arm and the doctor wouldn't be able to stop it.
And another thing, when I first watched this episode, I was like, what the hell? She's never taken charge before. Well, except maybe Rings of Akutan or something. But, she doesn't seem like a Amy Pond, take charge kind of person. And suddenly she was doing all this and knew how to, she had the idea about the moat around the castle and all that stuff. But after reading his email, on second viewing, it actually did feel kind of more organic that she, she's learned from the doctor, so she is able to take charge and she does a lot of things, but she still gets things wrong. So she did let him grab that trigger. So it's not like she didn't just suddenly become a superhero. It didn't feel so bad after, his qualm about this actually made me appreciate it more.
I love the line that she had where she's like, I'm alive because I listen to what the doctor says. And somebody's like, so you trust him? I wouldn't go that far. I thought that was great.
Well, I think it specifically the setup was that you trust him to know what to do.
Yeah, something like that. I'm misquoting
she wouldn't trust, yeah. Although, it's a valid point. I'm not certain that I'm quite content with the waffling back and forth of Clara's capabilities episode to episode. And I understand, different people at the script, different people at the helm, produced at different points, you know, and a different sequence. So maybe this was just as, you know, as she was crafting the character around her understanding of Clara, that Coleman was putting something more or less into these. But I don't, it seems stuttered to me.
Well, if you ask 10 different Whovians who's in charge in the show, or who the main person should be focused and everything like that, you know, you're going to get a lot of different answers. And it could be simply that, you know, this writer has the idea that, you know, the doctor needs a damsel to save in order to show how cool he is. And this person says, no, he needs the companion to keep him grounded and take charge when he can't do it. And so it's like, you've got a lot of different opinions, and that could be all it is just, you've got people writing her from different viewpoints. And at that point, I think Moffat needs to be the one to step in and say, hey, look, no, I'm the showrunner. This is how we're going to go with the character. You know?
Well, and I think it probably feels so stuttered because we see, like, some episodes she's in every scene and some episodes she's barely in it at all.
Yeah. And I mean, I think last week, you know, she was a side character at best, but the little bit that we did get from her started to feel more like what we knew with Oswin and with Victorian Clara. And in this one, it's, you know, we're getting more into that back and forth that they had. And, you know, I didn't really pay too much attention to the fact that this isn't how she's been all along, because this is what I've wanted her to be all along. So I didn't hang up on that so much just because I was relieved. I'm like, thank God they've got her where she is, you know. Hmm. So.
And we'll come back around again on this in terms of you're talking about her, what we do or don't get out of her, or do or don't know about her, as we get towards the end of this particular episode. Mm-hmm. But we were talking very quickly, you know, when we were discussing her dealing with both the doctor and Mr. Clever across the table there. That is, I'll pull the brake for the moment and give huge props to Steve Smith or to Matt Smith for being able to carry that as well as he did. Which, according to an interview with Gaiman, was something he added later on. He needed something compelling to give the doctor to do, and came up with this chess match concept.
And he'd said that, you know, he wouldn't have trusted this to anyone else. It was because it was Matt Smith that, and I was like, you know, how is it that someone who's never written for, or who wrote for him one time, can see this when we've got, you know, veteran writers who are still writing him the same way? Like, yeah. Matt Smith is a good actor if you give him good material.
Precisely.
And I think that he did a fantastic job with that. I mean, it could have very easily devolved into something really hokey and stupid, but, you know, Matt's
Flexo doctor and regular doctor and just a goatee. Yeah.
Yes. It's evil, Abed. No.
Yeah.
I think that Matt Smith just did a fantastic job with that. And, you know, at times I was like, yeah, you shouldn't really be spinning around like that. That's a little bit goofy. But when push came to shove, I mean, he really nailed it.
Well, the whole spinning around thing, on BBC America, they do these, like, you know, interviews in the commercials. And he said they were interviewing Matt Smith, and he was like, and it was accomplished really easily. I just go like this, and he, like, throws his shoulder, and then I'm him, and, like, he throws the other shoulder. And, like,
and they would add a sound effect to make it zap.
Yeah. And, I mean, I thought that was a good visual way of, like, you know, saying, okay, this is definitely who it is. And then as time goes on, you don't get that anymore. It's like the lines are starting to get a little bit blurred and you're having trouble seeing, you know, determining exactly who it is.
Mm-hmm. But I appreciate that. I appreciate the fact that the difference between them was very subtle. You had to look for slight facial features. You had to look, you know, he did a slight change to his accent, things of that sort. And just the way that he was taking that sinister pleasure out of things going horribly, horribly awry.
And I mean, the thing that got me when I first watched it, I kept getting hung up on that. I kept thinking, he's a cyber planner. He, you know, no emotions, completely logical. He should be a robot. You know, and then the more I thought about it, it's like, you know, that's not the case. He's not cold and logical. You know, he acted exactly like Time Lords do when they lose control and go insane. You know, here you've got someone who, you know, basically gets all this knowledge and just goes crazy with it. You know, it's, and that's the great thing is we've seen, you know, I mean, every Time Lord is at risk for this. And, you know, David Tennant would really kind of push that line a lot, especially towards the end, you know, with the Time Lord Victorious thing. And it seemed, once I put it in that filter, it seemed much, much better than, you know, having Matt Smith talking normally and then going robot. You know,
Yes, and take into account the fact that this is the first time that the planner had ever tried to adapt its neural interface to Time Lord brain structure.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it kept discussing the fact that it was, you know, sort of a stranger in a strange land, and appreciating the fact that it had some work to do because there were kinks that needed to get worked out, and it had such potential.
So are you saying, Jay, like that, I'm trying to understand what you're saying about, because it bothered me that he wasn't so cyber, but again, like from an acting and visual, you know, mm-hmm. entertainment standpoint, I liked it. But are you saying like it was because the cyber planner was filtered through the doctor, or do you think that it actually was him like going crazy at a certain point?
I mean, it was kind of, you take this personality and, or this, you know, this persona and push it into the doctor with none of his lifetime of restraint and learning how to control himself and anything like that. You know, if I took your consciousness and put it into the doctor with none of his restraint and none of his experiences to temper yourself, then, you know, I think the same thing would happen to you. You know, where it's too much to take in. You're, you know, all of a sudden you become a god, where these robots have taken over man, and, you know, time and time again, it's just like, okay, strip the emotions and, you know, operating system.
Right.
And here you give it a completely new platform with so much more potential, and it's, you know, you get power hungry and go nuts.
Right. I like that operating system analogy. It's the idea of, you know, if the Siberium is expecting to be able to go at zeroing out the mental capacities and the emotional capacities of its, you know, call it a victim, all right, for the sake of argument, and it's always been going up against humans at this point, so it has that format down, okay, clean slate, layover, occupy, and it can stay cold, clinical, surgical, the way that it does when it takes over either of the kids or Wembley or what have you. It hits the doctor, and it's unable to smooth out the playing field first. So it keeps running into these bumps, and it's like buggy software. It's attempting to do what it's supposed to do, but it keeps running up against these obstacles that cause it to stutter and skip and behave erratically. Still attempting to get its work done, but is doing so very haphazardly, which is, I think, one of the only things that saves him in the end. So.
Okay.
Talking about the whole idea of the of taking control and so forth, that leads to one of Shooter's questions about how we get out of this situation. You know, the three moves, five moves bit, and there's the fact that Porridge just happens to drop near the doctor's feet after he goes after Wembley, or Cyber Wembley, I should say. So what exactly knocks Porridge out? I mean, all he did is he went after Wembley's leg, because he's, you know, can't take out a headshot, clearly. Womp womp.
Yeah.
Dude, well, he got kicked across the room. That was the way I saw it. Like, he's little. He just went flying. Like, he bounced off of him and went flying.
I've got two explanations for it. A, the actual explanation in the fact that it was a plot device and it needed to get over to that side of the room, so hey, jump over there so the doctor can grab that off your hand. As far as story goes, you know, it's like, I figured it's supposed to hit the back of the head where everything is clustered, where it's supposed to take the entire jolt and, you know, disperse it throughout the body. Well, you hit the leg, there's not as much nerve to take that entire blast. Maybe it was some kind of, you know, discharge, because it couldn't get the full blast in there, so there was a discharge that knocked him.
Yeah, it seems legit. Just let it go. Wave your hands.
Exactly. This is Doctor Who.
It's probably done with mirrors. So, and then some of the other things that he was dealing with, obviously, you know, the fact that thankfully, and I've got a slightly different take than you do on this, Jay. The question about the fact that we bring up the Doctor's erasing himself from history, which was so prevalent, quite a while back, and nobody had really been addressing in a lot of the scripts that we'd gotten in some time, through series 7. And the fact that these Doctor was erasing himself, and it may, I'm piggybacking this with a shooter second question, leaving holes, in the historical records, so that he makes the comment that he would have to go back and actually, fix those holes so that, so the memory of his records would not be able to be reconstructed from the gaps. So did this seem a little out of left field to the two of you?
Honestly, to me, it was just like, oh, they're getting ready for the big reveal of everything next week.
Okay.
Yeah, that's how it felt to me. Like, I'm like, oh, I'm glad they're bringing this back because, you know, it seems like it might be important if we're going to Trenzalore next week.
Because, I mean, the last time we heard about it was The Angels Take Manhattan. But the last time we saw anyone that would really be paying attention to that thing, that kind of thing, was Angels Take Manhattan. Yeah. Ever since then, we've had people from, you know, the past or that had no idea who the Doctor was or anything like that. So this is really, I mean, if you think about it like that, this is the first time that it actually would be able to come up where someone's like, hey, you're the Doctor. I know you. Why can't I find any record of you?
Well, we had some allusion to that in Asylum of the Daleks because of the fact that he was no longer in the Dalek mainframe either.
Yeah, I mean, we got him through the first part of the series pretty regularly, but in the second half, this is the first reference. So it's, you know, the last time we heard it was River Song saying something about him erasing himself from history, and then we get nothing until now.
Right. It just seemed interesting that that happened to be another Clara tie-in, or in that case, an Oswin tie-in. I looked at it as this. It's a tip of the hat to Gaiman in the fact that as a real Whovian fan in his own right, he pays attention to some of the details that we as fans wanting to have certain things handed to us or given to us over the course of this particular series, he wants to write those things in because he's wondering them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to see that happen. So I'm not sure if it was necessarily done as a matter of just kind of leading us into what we know the finale was going to be because he penned this on his own and then, you know, handed it to Moffat to start taking apart, which he did. He did a little bit of hacking to it. But it was a matter of this is what he would want to see as any fan sitting at home saying, yeah, but what about Trenzalore? Come on! You know, you can't just leave these kind of gaps behind and not have, you know, some of the most capable collective consciousnesses that are, you know, centuries, if not millennia old in their own right, that, well, in this case, yeah, millennia old, that would not be wondering about the fact that this brilliant mind that drops into their midst has never been referenced before. So, yeah, I think that's just a matter of a good writer paying attention to what the fans would want to see.
Yeah, and it was his writing that said about how he could be reconstructed from the holes in it, which is something we hadn't really considered.
Yeah, that was definitely thinking on a different level than I had approached it. You know, you look at, government documents where all the lines have been blacked out for security purposes, and it's just killing you. You got to know what was originally there. So you start doing some reverse engineering to find out what was stricken from the record kind of thing. But yeah, that's a really interesting premise.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's a good one that we haven't taken apart yet as we get towards the end of the episode, which is the fact that, you know, the cyber planner nearly grabs Clara by the lapels and starts discussing the impossible girl reference to her. Now, knowing that her memory of all of this information has been removed at the end of Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, so this is all new to her again, and yet she does not bring it up with the Doctor after they clear the scene and they're dropping everybody back off in London.
Yeah. I've got to say, Shooter, I'm right there with you on this one. It bothers the crap out of me. there's no reason why it shouldn't be brought up and why she should just hop off the TARDIS happy as anything, like, all right, see you next Wednesday. Like, do you not understand the gravity of what you were told? Mm-hmm. Like, are you not even the slightest bit curious?
Again, I gotta wonder how much of these things were on the original script and how many were edited later in the production cycle as a means to stitch episodes together in the way that they were sequenced for air date.
It definitely felt tacked on.
Yeah. And it seems like this entire half of the series was just like, all right, let's write a bunch of stories. And once they got all the scripts, they're like, okay, we're going to put them in this order. Quick, somebody sit down and write something to, like, get from here to here to here.
Right. Yep. And one of the things that I've been starting to think about now, especially just with these last two episodes, is that I'm wondering whether or not the latter half of this series would work better if you were to have presented them in a slightly different order. Really wouldn't have to do any edits to them, but just sort of take them in order of the importance of the Clara mystery and let that start to ramp up.
Yeah.
We were poking around at this last week and wondering whether or not, you know, Akaten would have worked out better if we stuck it later in the series, but mm-hmm. I think a bunch of them could stand to have the deck shuffled a bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a lot like the whole Star Wars thing, and, like, which order do you watch them in? And clearly the one that we were given them isn't the correct order anymore. Mm. So, yeah, that would be kind of fun to do that. I mean, it's one of those things that, I mean, it's fun to do with this show in general, you know, going back and watching River Song's episodes according to her timeline and, mm-hmm. you know, trying to piece together, are we watching this from the Doctor's timeline or from Clara's, or, you know, are they different? Anything, you know, we could be watching it completely out of order compared to what we should be watching it. And that might be something we get tipped to next week.
Right. Well, it's,
I have some other plot holes that I want to talk about, if you guys don't mind.
Okay. We'll devote a little more time to this, and then we're going to start seeing some positive things, because we want to make sure that we give this a fair balance.
Yeah.
All right, so first of all, the TARDIS made a phone. Okay, what the hell? Like, the TARDIS can make phones. He says that she has a too tight skirt. If the line is in the script, can't you just tell wardrobe, like, that we require a tight skirt instead of giving her this, like, swingy, loose skirt? Like, that bothered me more than it should have, but it was at the end of the episode, so I was like, all right, I'll let it slide.
This Gallifrey Public Radio Fashion Report brought to you by...
They don't know what a tight skirt is. And then the main thing that I have a problem with is, if Porridge could have just scooped them all up with his... whatever, why didn't he do that in the first place instead of letting all these people get killed?
I think, personally, that has to go back to the fact that through this entire episode, he has been wrestling with the repercussions of his position of authority.
Mm-hmm. He didn't want to be the Emperor anymore. He was trying to stay away from it and was willing to, you know, drag it out as long as he could to see if he could still escape it.
I mean, that's all well and good, but... you know, people died, like, and we're still looking at him like, oh, he was this awesome emperor or whatever, but, like, you know.
Unless he felt that he had to stick it out until the use of the bomb was inevitable. Because if he just bailed everybody out there, then he's leaving countless scores of Cybermen behind that are eventually going to get off that planet and start wreaking havoc again.
And he said at the, you know, when he was explaining to Clara about the big black spot in the sky, you know, he was like, you know, I don't think about all that stuff. I think how horrible it is for that one guy who had to push the button.
Yeah. You
know, and he didn't want to push that button. He, you know, everything points to the fact that he already did it once and doesn't want to relive that.
And I think, and I give so much credit to Davis for wearing that weight in his shoulders well. He played it so subtly, and yet it had so much gravity to it.
Oh yeah, I mean he took this, you know, gave it such a sincerity and such a seriousness that anyone else in that role probably would have cost this episode something. Hmm.
It's actually funny. The other day, I heard someone was saying, they were like, "Oh, this actor, I can't remember his name, he's a little person, but he's a great actor." And I was like, Warwick Davis? They're like, yes, that was him. Like,
Well, you got two. You got either Warwick Davis or you got Peter Dinklage.
Yeah.
And Tony Cox is the other little actor in Hollywood. I can't think of a fourth.
Oh no, you got the guy who played all the Oompa Loompas in Willy Wonka, and he's been in all the X-Files episodes. And okay. What is his name?
Something Deep. Indian.
Yes, Sanjeev Deep.
No, I don't.
Anyway.
But I want to go back. I think back to what we were saying before. I don't think it was him who pulled the trigger on the Tiberian galaxy, because they said that the cyber war had been over for 1,000 years. So I assumed that was what ended the war. So unless you know humans are living thousands of years, it wasn't him that.
Well, nothing said that he was human though.
True.
Yeah, maybe he looks Time Lord.
Yeah. I just assumed that he was he was feeling like an empathy for his predecessor who had to push the button.
And that very well could be what it is. It's true. I didn't think about how long it had been.
True. You said you still had a couple of other things that you want, or was that your, that was your,
that was my main one. I think I had, why was he working at Wembley's in the first place? Wasn't the carnival, the amusement park shut down? Like, why did they need someone in that Cyberman to, that made no sense to me.
I think that was just a hiding place.
He was at Wembley.
Webley, sorry.
I think it was just like, he wound up hiding. He's like, hey, an abandoned amusement park planet. People aren't going to look for me here. And wound up running into Webley and saying, hey, you know, this could work out between us.
Did you not feel it was a little unusual? I mean, the captain seemed so intrigued at the fact that that Angie was referring to a little person, and she was about to kind of pick her brain on that. And when she finally does actually see that it is the Emperor, and she knows that it's the Emperor, she doesn't react at all.
Well, I mean, the thing you've got to consider is that we don't know how long he's been on the run. We don't know that she's, you know, he may not be a highly publicized figure. You know, it might be that it's just the picture on the coin, that's him. You know, and that's the only way people ever see him. We don't know that she's ever met him or seen him or anything like that. It, you know, there could be a lot of explanations for that.
I don't know, because moments later, or I should say scenes later, she does know exactly who he is.
Yeah, she figures it out. And I mean, that's what it looks like. She's like, oh, so it was you. Yeah, and I don't know. It's one of those things that I was able to hand wave very easily. I don't know if other people are getting really hung up on it, but it didn't bother me all that much.
Well, that I never even thought of it, but like she perks up when Angie says the little guy, but then it seems like they only know him like from the coins, and he's portrayed as taller in other things. So I don't know how she knew that he was.
Honestly, it might be the fact that, you know, she said little guy and she's like, oh wait, there's a little guy working with that guy. We've been trying to run off planet. You know, maybe I can get some information about getting rid of them.
Possible.
I mean, they're just, honestly, this whole story, I feel like it should have been a two-part episode. Yeah. There could have been a lot more and a lot more depth and story put into it and made it feel more, more fulfilled.
Possible. I'm not really sure how much more I would want to stretch this, though, because I worry that because of the fact that this was a very, you know, kind of hyper-stylized Scooby-Doo episode, you know, for all intents and purposes, that trying to extend it would just leave us picking more apart?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like had it been put into two episodes, they might have gotten away from the Scooby-Doo-ness of it, though. You know, where it's like, okay, let's spend X amount of time fleshing these characters out, make them feel like real people instead of just, hey, we need, you know, all the rejects from the Geek Squad to try and form a army platoon. And it's like, give those characters some depth and let us understand, okay, they're there for a reason. They wanted to be in the army. They're not just there to be a, you know, a physical representation of how horrible this platoon is.
I would have been interested in finding out what the captain's backstory was and the fact that she kept giving these sort of these wistful references to the fact that she had been following or she failed to follow orders once and that was why she was here.
Yeah.
You know, and those moments make you think, oh, okay, well, maybe we're going to get more out of this. And we never did.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe not a two-part episode, but at least 60 minutes. I mean, I would have loved to have seen just a bit more fleshing out.
I'm curious. I don't know if we're going to see these kids again.
I don't know. God, I hope not. I'm over them. I'm so over. I honestly was over them in Bells of St. John.
Okay. I don't know if that's going to happen, because I think the reason why they made a specific point of having the TARDIS provide Angie with a new phone is so that it's a phone that will allow her to reach Clara no matter where she is.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine. She can be just a plot device that needs to reach Clara. Screen time is what I think we're against.
Yeah, I think that the fact that they brought the kids along and they were the first ones to get kidnapped robbed the entire episode of any of its drama. Because, I mean, as soon as you see kids put in danger, you know nothing's going to happen, because this is Doctor Who. You don't kill kids. You know, and no, the doctor's
Torchwood is for.
Yeah, exactly. And the doctor saying, you know, no one's going to die. It's like, well, you know, you just robbed it of any suspense there is. You know, it's like, everyone's going to get out okay now.
Right. Yeah.
Even though I really wanted to see the kids meet their demise in the first couple of minutes of the episode. Anyway, yeah. Get them out of the way, move yeah. on.
It wasn't the usual tension. It was more of like a hopeful thing.
Are they going to kill him? Are they going to do it? Please?
They're assimilated. Yay! Well, I think all in all, I'm glad we had this. I think this was something that we needed as a little bit of an energy boost.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in the series, I just wish we had gotten it a little sooner, and that the other writers had an opportunity to say, oh, wait, we're putting our work up against Mr. Gaiman's. I think we're going to need to polish off our A game
yeah.
on these scripts. I don't know. But let's, I mean, unless we've got some closing thoughts on this episode, this is a nice point to start to segue us into what we've got going on for next week.
Well, I do have a last point. I liked that it feels like it's going toward the 50th, because this was very, Time Lord centric, this episode. Mm-hmm. We got the knowledge that they invented chess. and then, you know,
which is so much sense.
Yeah,
it does. But again, it's like that could, to me, that feels like one of those things, like, you know, you could just throw that in, just try and impress it. Like, yeah, I invented the question mark.
Right. Right. And the doctor lies. So
the tasty freeze.
Yeah.
But I also liked that, again, like, I feel like this was like a lead up to the 50, that they were going through his previous incarnations. It says you've had 10 complete rejigs. And then he starts to get a little bit of a northern accent for a couple minutes, which, you know, not as full on northern accent that he did last week in Crimson Horror, but just a little bit. And he says fantastic, which was a beautiful nod to 9. And then he says Alonzi after that. So, like, yeah. You know, his stuff's getting all jumbled with the cyber planner in his brain. But I really liked that. And then, because it was all getting jumbled with the cyber planner, did you guys notice the way that he said, when he's talking to Clara, and like, I think it was the part where he was trying to get her to think that he liked her or whatever, he says, Clara, I suppose, in exactly the same way that 10 started to say to Rose, like, I guess if this is my last chance, then I suppose.
I didn't
pick up on that.
No, I didn't either. I was too happy about the fact that she slapped him, like, yeah, no, that's not you. Like, yay! That made me happy.
I liked that too, but I just thought it was like a good, you know, his previous regions are all still there somewhere in him. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes. And leave it to a writer who is as much of a classic Whovian fan as Moffat is to want to bring those things up. In an episode where any of our other writers so far in the latter half of Series 7 would just glaze over it and stick to the adventure at hand.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that's something that that we needed at this point, and it's going to be a nice lead into next week. The 50th being what it is, and the fact that, you know, people are, like, chomping at the bit to try and spoil it for everybody, but we've still got a finale to get through, which, as we were starting to refer to, you know, half an hour or so ago, is seeming like it's coming at us very quickly from around a corner. I don't feel like I've been worked up to this. I was watching the scenes, you know, the advanced trailer at the close of this past episode, and they're giving you the 30-second, you know, fast edit, you know, whiz bang, all this stuff happening. Aren't you excited? And the score is thumping, and people are crying, and things are exploding, and you know, there's jumping around. And there's all going to be this big amazing thing, and oh, we've got the guys with no eyeballs, and look, there's the return of the great intelligence. By the way, thank you very friggin' much. The great intelligence is back, and they want us to get really excited, and I'll admit I'm excited, but I haven't been excited up to this point.
Yeah. I mean, it was one of those things. I was sitting there and I started watching this episode. I'm like, all right, yeah, the Neil Gaiman, wait a minute. That means next week is it. Like, I had not thought about it and, you know, at all. Like, I hadn't put it in perspective, and it's just kind of like, where the hell did this come from?
Yeah, I got a tweet from one of our listeners saying, wait a second, guys, the finale is next week.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it, did it?
Yeah. But, so talking about that though, is there has been a bit of a mix up with the DVDs, and this is slightly old news by now, but, apparently someone at BBC America shipped out the Series 7B box set a little bit early. So there have been some fans that got the season finale already.
Yeah, and BBC is begging people to stop spoiling it.
Yeah. Now, I think it's kind of interesting. Like, Moffat said, okay, I'm aware of what happened. Please, if you have that copy, do not leak the ending. Don't say anything. And if you guys come through for me on this, after the finale, I will give you guys a special scene between Matt Smith and David Tennant. So.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, okay, yes, I will keep my mouth shut. I don't know anything, but I'm still going to keep my mouth shut.
Well, but people are still spoiling. There's like a controversy on Reddit because people are just spamming people's inboxes with the answers. Just some asshole trolls are just being what they are.
No matter what you put out there, no matter how much begging and pleading, the tendency for the functioning public to want to spoil something. If you've got information that's just burning a hole in your pocket, And you fall in that category, you're gonna ruin it. You feel compelled to ruin it for everyone because there's some satisfaction in knowing that you were able to cut the legs out from under a great, you know, production juggernaut. I don't think it's something that we can avoid.
I mean, I don't know. I'm like, you know, think about how great it was, like sitting down to watch, you know, Asylum of the Daleks. And all of a sudden, Jenna Louise Coleman pops up on screen. You're like, whoa, wait a minute, what? I'm like, that. Yeah. I mean, I love that feeling. And I've been diligently staying away from the internet just so that I don't accidentally come across something, you know, which made putting the news segment for this week together very difficult.
Quite. Yeah.
I mean, I've become even more spoiler phobic. Like, I actually want to, like, apologize to our listeners because I feel like in the past I have spoiled, like, you know, even light spoilers now feel too spoilery. So, That said, so we're now doing our news at the end of the podcast. So this is all news that we're in now, but I don't think there's anything really too spoilery out there right now, right? That we've.
Well, other than the wave of things that we had already tried to shove past and not acknowledge, you know, we've been.
Well, we're not going to acknowledge anything too spoilery.
Right.
Well, so we do have some teasers and trailers and prequels for The Name of the Doctor. Which, I mean, the more I watch these, I've watched them probably 10 or 12 times a piece, and it's just every time I get more and more excited. Just, yay! It looks awesome.
Let me just put this out because this is the predominant question. This is one where, you know, a lot of the other people who run their various podcasts and blogs and fan sites as well really come down to one key concern. And this is not a matter of a spoiler. This is really just a matter of the basic premise of what we think we're supposed to be getting out of this finale. Should the Doctor's name be revealed?
No.
Or, okay.
Sorry. No, well, go ahead and finish your question. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump the gun.
And whichever side of the fence that you come down on, you know, is there a particular reason for saying that I either shouldn't or could without major repercussions? I know my personal response on it, and Jay, I kind of know your personal response on this. But I want a little a little fleshing out as to why you might feel that way.
I mean, my main thing is, you know, okay, say we find out that, you know, his name is, you know, Bob Goldthwait. Yeah, it's what's that gonna do for the show? I mean, really, you're not gonna get anything out of finding out that, you know, his name actually is John Smith. Holy crap, we've known it the whole time. Big deal. Yeah, it's not gonna do anything for the show.
It reminds me of on Lost, there's a character in the sixth season that was just known as the Man in Black. And they never tell you the name, but there was, you know, it was leaked that like on his dressing room, it said Samuel, and people are like, well, okay. So if his name is Samuel, like what does that mean? Who cares? Like, who cares what his name is? And then they did a little, parody YouTube video with the actors, and there's like, I forget what the name was, but they're like, you know, it was something really silly, and they're making fun of him for that being the name. And I feel my biggest fear is that that's where they're gonna go with the Doctor, that they're like, you know, oh, he's got some kind of like silly name. And does that make sense? Like, if they reveal it, so what? It was Barry. They're like, oh, Barry's your name. Like, so what? What if the Doctor's name is Barry? Like,
I think the only thing that it can possibly hope to do is undermine one of the basic premises of the show, in the fact that his anonymity is part of what has kept him safe up to this point. You know, the secrets keep us safe. And that recurrence is just something that it's just part of the underpinning. Getting it back, it's not a superpower. It's not a mystery that can take down nations or races, as far as we know. But it's a matter of that identity is something that has allowed him to be able to function as he has been able to sort of, you know, breeze in and breeze out of all of these times and places without causing too much of a butterfly effect. You know,
my objection is more just the show's been on 50 years and they've never said, like, just keep with the tradition and don't reveal the name.
I'm really hoping that it's just Moffat trying to be clever with the title, and, you know, maybe he reveals his name to Clara, or Clara finds out his name and all kinds of crap comes from that, but we as viewers still don't know it. I would love that. That would be a great way to do that. Like, if you're going to reveal his name, awesome. Just don't do it to the audience.
Yes. Yeah. And which I think, if that were to be the case, think about the public reaction. You'd end up with a nice flame war, which we all thrive on.
Oh, yes.
Where all the people who maybe just a week prior saying, you know, you shouldn't reveal the name because then you have to change the title of the show. And then if they don't give the name away, or they give it to a character, then it's done, you know, off frame, or, you know, sotto voce or something like that. And they'll be out there the next week saying, it wasn't fair that you were going to call the entire episode the name of the Doctor and then never reveal it. And, like, if you guys are just looking to find something to gripe about, I've got 7 other series that you can start watching now and just leave us alone. You know, I'd like something left to the imagination.
Yeah, and I mean, especially if you know the history of where the show's name came from. You know, they'd come up with the concept for the show, and they, you know, had this character, and they were getting real close to starting production, but they didn't have a name for the character. So someone wrote on the little board that they had all their notes on, you know, Doctor ? Who ? Like, you know, who is this guy? And it stuck. And I'm like, that's great that, you know, this mystique has been part of the show since its conception. You know, it was built into the show from the ground up, basically. It's like, don't rob it of that.
Yeah.
I really hope and pray that you're right, Jay, on the fact that it's going to be something where it's either a matter of playing with the premise, you know, the sort of the Bells of St. John kind of a, you know, look over here, don't look over here, look over here, look over, don't look over here. Or that it's something where it's revealed to the story, but not to the audience. Because I think just that aspect of it is also pulling away from the fact that there is another plot going on in this, and we know we're going to be dealing with Trenzalore. We know we're going to be dealing with, you know, the return of River, who I've been waiting to see for so long. And it's like this, that whole premise is getting lost in this hype over the naming. But I'm excited about everything else about the episode.
Yes.
Good point.
I get to appreciate it. And the fact that I want to see, you know, what the revelation, if not the explanation, of the Clara mystery is really going to be. Even though we're coming at it sort of as if we just had the, you know, we just jumped back onto the treadmill after it had already gotten up to full running speed. you know, you're not going to ease me into it. You're just going to throw me in the deep end. But I still want to know, you know, what he's been playing with all along. And whether or not maybe he's far more genius than we realized as a showrunner, and he's been giving us clues all along, and we've been so wrapped up in all this other crap and
why are the light bulbs flashing? Dang it!
Exactly. And we didn't have one of those. You know, the whole light bulb thing turned out to be a total red herring. Fine, but maybe there's something else that we haven't been able to see all along because of the fact that we've been too busy, you know, rattling our sabers, shaking our pitchforks and torches at some of the holes in the last few scripts we've been given.
But we're fans. That's what we're supposed to do. We're saber rattlers.
And you call yourself a Whovian.
Yeah, but no, but that's just it. Maybe we're so busy, you know, railing against the fact that, you know, you never explained why the words "help me" were written on the friggin' wall. that we didn't notice the fact that there was a little guy standing just off in the background who's kind of, you know, waving his little fingers and saying, "Hi, I'm the villain. I've been here all along." Poof, and he's gone again.
Yeah, and I mean, that's – Moffat has said that too. I mean, he said there have been all kinds of clues hidden in plain sight, and nobody's picked up on them. It's
great.
I'm going to be so happy to be proven wrong about – like, I hope there is a little guy in every scene.
That'd be fantastic. Wait a minute. It's that guy. It's that extra. It's always back there just, you know, wiping down the table. Oh, hello. Don't mind me. I'm just over here. I'm cleaning this table. Moving matchbooks slightly to the left. That's no big thing.
Yeah. I'm excited. I mean, I can't remember the last time I've been this excited about a series finale, and I've only felt that way for like 3 days. That's the crazy part.
Well, it's since all the – because this episode that we're talking about now had nothing to do with the finale, but when all the extras came out with the prequel and stuff, now I'm excited. I had watched the BBC America trailer on BBC America, and there was no information, and I start, like, you hear River's voice but don't see her, so I was thinking, like, oh my god, what if the theory that Clara and River are the same person ends up being true? Like, I started, like, panicking and thinking that. And then they put out the prequel, and I'm sorry. I want to talk about the prequel after this. But then I saw the other trailer, and River is speaking to Clara. Mm-hmm. It's just voiceover in the BBC America, but whatever the line is, she's actually speaking it to Clara, which is getting me really excited. I'm excited to see a scene between these two.
Mm. Yeah. I would love to see some River Song hackles up in dealing with this, you know, this little tart that's kicking around the TARDIS right now.
Oh yeah.
But leading into the prequel. So, okay. Let's take this apart here.
Oh geez. I don't know if it's going to be, you know, if this is like a literal prequel as in this is canon, or if this is just something like, hey, this is a clever way to lead up to the episode. It doesn't feel like it's supposed to fit into the story.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, the word prequel is coming from BBC, but I don't think that it actually fits in the episode. It would be really weird if, like, you could fit these two monologues into an episode, not into an episode, but, like, as part of the canon.
Well, yeah, it was very similarly to the whole playground swing set moment, you know, that we had from that one little episode prequel earlier this series where, you know, Doctor's just sitting there talking about, oh, I lost a friend, and talking to the girl, and it turns out to be a young Clara and so forth. Didn't have any bearing on the episode. It was just a little bit of a tee-up. Didn't really provide as much of anything, but, you know, we watched it multiple times because that's what we do, and it just, you know, it just keeps everybody's appetite wet. I don't think this is going to be anything, but they said, what, it's going to run about 3 minutes or so, I think. supposed to be relatively lengthy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
It's, I mean, it's very interesting, and actually seeing some of the stuff we've been wanting all series, where, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, I don't know why the doctor doesn't trust me, and what's his secret, what's he hiding from me, and, you know, what's her deal, and how is she possible, and things like that. And so, like, all these questions we've been begging for the past 7 episodes, and we finally get them now, and it's like, oh, but there's nothing to follow it up with yet.
At least it seems like they're going to answer them. At least they've acknowledged the questions are there.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, okay. Well, then that we'll consider that to be the giant box, insert magic here, you know, on the page, and we've still got a little bit more that we're continuing to get pumped about the 50th. And even a little bit about series 8, which I felt was completely unnecessary. But the fact that that Moffat had to come out and say, yes, there will be more of the show. We're not ending it after the 50th yes. anniversary.
Could you imagine? God,
oh, jeez. Yeah.
Just, good night, everybody. Drops the microphone.
It's been great. No.
But I guess one of the things that we had talked about really early on was how the broadcast format was going to be for Series 8. And that in and of itself has not yet been kind of taken apart. Just the fact that it will exist and it will be arriving very late.
Mm-hmm.
But we still don't know whether they're going to even... I haven't really heard anything advancing those early rumors that he was considering going the Sherlock, quote-unquote movie releases... the 90-minute format and very few episodes. Has that gone anywhere since back at the beginning of the series?
No, I mean, there's not really been anything that's come out. It's just there, you know, everything was leading up to the finale, and then now everything's leading up to the 50th, and we're not getting any information about anything beyond that. I mean, the fact that Moffat came out and said, hey, it's officially confirmed there will be a Series 8, I mean, that's the first information we've gotten of anything that's supposed to come after the 50th.
And I think one of the only things he was able to really kind of divulge about it is, I'm very tired. I've been working very hard. I can't really go into a lot of detail because I can't even really think that far in advance yet. I'm kind of busy. So.
Well, and I mean, with Matt Smith doing the movie, you know, he's shaved his head. Yeah, it's the pictures are kind of funny. He actually looks kind of evil, but
he had to match his eyebrows.
Exactly. I don't know. It's they've got to give him time to look the part again. You know, they've got to have time to do the whole 50th build up and, you know, what comes after that and everything. So it's, I wouldn't be surprised if we do have a decent wait. You know, clearly we're going to have a Christmas episode. I mean, you can't avoid that. It's Doctor Who, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Guys?
Yes, we'll have our.
But, you know, beyond that, who knows? You know, it could be that we have to wait until the following fall again.
That could be a record-setting break.
Oh, geez, yeah.
He's done it with Sherlock. It could, you know.
Yeah, and people are still waiting patiently. They'll line up at the door and continue to camp out there for as long.
I don't know about patiently, but we're waiting.
Patient. What else can you do? Squeeze the man? Write something! Film something!
Yeah, but... So Steemo has been talking about the 50th anniversary. He was interviewed at the BAFTA Awards, you know, and he was saying, you know, don't believe everything that you hear or haven't heard. You know, it's like there's all kinds of rumors going around. You know, there's all kinds of stuff saying, you know, this is in it and this isn't. And, you know, nobody has confirmed anything aside from the fact that, or you know, he said that it was the only stuff that's been confirmed is the stuff that they filmed outdoors.
Right.
You know, so everything that's happened behind closed doors, you know, it's still a secret. And he's like, I'm not telling anybody.
I had wondered about that earlier. I mean, I was saying, you know, have you guys heard anything about where the B company is filming through all this? I mean, they've only been shooting for a couple of days outside. They need a lot more material.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, the simple fact is that, you know, there's a lot that he's trying to do with this, and he's not going to ruin it by telling us now.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're very good at keeping secrets, except when they sent the DVDs early.
Yeah. So.
I'm thankfully, you know, I can't believe, you know, as we're recording this, we are mere days away from our finale. And I'm sure that we're going to have loads to talk about. I don't know if we're going to end up doing, you know, a considerably longer episode to recap, or whether it's something where we will try to restrain ourselves and sort of keep discussion of the finale as we've seen it. And then maybe in an episode that follows, we can start to talk about, you know, all right, what repercussions did this have on all the things that we were griping about in the series, or at least the latter half of the series prior? Because I think this is going to have a quite a bit of a ripple effect going back.
Mm-hmm.
I like that idea. We could split it in two.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have plenty of time before we get new content, so.
True.
We could split it into five.
For the next 4 months, we do.
There are definitely some things that I'll be bringing up with the two of you offline about some ideas of things, based a lot on some of the feedback and the questions that we've gotten from week to week about, you know, references back and forth between classic and New Who, extended universe material, published content, things like that, that I think could warrant some pretty interesting episodes to come too, since we're going to have a break of indeterminate length. So we'll see where we go with that. But I will say this much for the two of you. Get yourself a good digital comic reader, because I want to take apart some of the Doctor Who adventures that I think connect very well to some of the things that we've discussed both during the series and during our villain arc that we did prior to 7B starting up, that really got a lot of people and us interested in connecting the dots from classic to new. Yeah. So through all of that, referring to all of the feedback, the comments, the input, the crosstalk, the screaming and yelling, the, you know, you're stupid, no, you're stupid, that we've been relying on a lot of listeners for. Melissa, how can we make sure that people continue to do so as we get through the next couple of weeks and go through our withdrawal pains?
We will tweet about it a lot.
We will tweet quite a bit about it. We've got our Twitter handle, which unlike everything else, where it's GallifreyPublicRadio.com as a website, or for email, feedback@GallifreyPublicRadio.com. Please note that if you're trying to tweet us, it is just @GallifreyRadio. I had a couple people that were trying to do an @GallifreyPublicRadio and Twitter
it won't
spit
fit.
Up.
Yeah.
It'll spit on you.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the one that just, they said, nope, you can't have that. That's too much. So, but, so.
I sum up. It's too much.
Yeah, so, I mean, send in your questions, your comments, all stuff like that. I mean, we've got plenty of time to talk about it now that things are winding down.
And contribute if you can. I'm going to be trying to get more involved in this as well. The non-episode driven posts over at Gallifrey Public Radio that could use your feedback as well. I've got one that's kind of itching at me a little bit that I'm going to have to make sure that I compose myself and my thoughts clearly before I start to get into or climb up onto my soapbox. But when I do so, I'm really going to want to hear from the public at large about the whole, the screwdriver as a magic wand issue, because that's really bugging me a lot lately. So keep an eye out on the forum or over on the blog for that. So, closing thoughts, kids.
I'm happy that we're finally getting something, you know, that we can discuss and be happy with. Yeah, as opposed to, well, it was wrong for this reason and that reason and this sucked and there was a happy part here, but the rest of it was horrible. And you
know, grr.
And the second half of the series has definitely been really lackluster, and it's nice to see it starting to turn around. I'm just hoping that Moffat can really pull it out at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it all rests on Murray Gold's shoulders anyway, when it really comes down to it.
Yeah, true.
If you did these episodes in silence, they'd be even worse. Are we good, kids? Yeah. Have we talked ourselves through?
I think that's it. So, well, this has been episode 37 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until
Mark
next,
two. Mark two.
Until next week, this is Jay saying the first politician who goes by the nickname Porridge gets my votes forever.
And this is Melissa saying, I hate the future. It's stupid. There's not even phone service.
And this is Kier saying, no, child, you're stupid.
Bye, guys.
How's he?
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so head over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review, send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, find us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, on Stitcher Smart Radio, or our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.
Jeez, right on top of it. I just logged in.
We're already talking.
Yeah, you're missing a lot.
Great. Blow out the whole conversation before we even start recording. Good. Another repetition of last week. That's
pretty
awesome.
Pretty much, yeah. No, we're done. All
right. Join us next week when you'll hear Jay say...